Welcome to Sweet and Twisted, a true crime podcast.
I'm Dawn.
I'm Anita. Be advised, there are trigger warnings in every episode. Each week, we will highlight a missing person so we can bring more awareness to their case.
Today, we will be highlighting Avril Juarez. Avril Juarez went missing on April 24th, 2023 from Madison, Wisconsin. She may have traveled with a male adult to Mexico. There's concern for her safety. She would now be 6 years old. She was 4 foot tall and weighed 50 pounds at the time of her disappearance. If you have any information, please contact the Madison Police Department at 608-261-9694.
Now on to today's cases. Now on to part two of Unsolved Heist. Hey, you fabulous sassholes, what another glorious Friday. Now, let's get started. Yeah, I know, short and sweet adjacent. Did you know that one of the world's largest gold coins is a 221-pound behemoth from Canada? It's called the Big Maple Leaf. The coin is 21 inches wide and an inch thick and had been housed in Berlin's Bode Museum. It was on loan from a private collector. Some sneaky ninjas got in and got out with that bad boy on March 27, 2017. According to police, the burglars apparently used a ladder and broke in through a window above railway tracks around 3:30 a.m. Then they had to smash through the bulletproof glass that surrounded the coin, lug the heavy son of a gun through the museum, up a flight of stairs, and back out the window that they entered from. Talk about getting some cardio in. Would you go through all the hassle of all of that?
No.
I put possibly. The face value of the coin is 1 million Canadian dollars, or about 750K U.S. dollars. So that's why I said possibly.
With that, maybe.
Yeah. The gold content, however, a whopping 4.5 million. Yep, they probably melted that bitch down and not give a rat's ass that the head of Queen Elizabeth II was on one side and a maple leaf on the other side. The perps were caught, but the whereabouts of the gold coin remains unknown. Investigators don't expect to recover the coin. Yes, I had a wee bit of a squirrel moment. I couldn't help it. I found it to be quite interesting, so I had to share more about it. Now, part two of Unsolved Heist is slightly different. These heists, the perpetrators were caught, but the stolen goods were never recovered. If you went to the extremes to be part of a heist, or the mastermind behind a heist, but was caught, would you give up the location of your bounty?
Don't think so.
Yeah. Me, nope, sure wouldn't. I then went down the rabbit hole and then got caught, so I'm going to be in trouble no matter what. Depending what I would be charged with, I'll get out of prison eventually. Also, depending on what evidence, if any, they would have on me, I may not be in that unflattering jumpsuit for long. So, when I got out, I'd have a nice bountiful of goods to fall back on and be able to start over. Remember, heathens, this is a what-if or what-would-you-do type scenario. Anywho, now on to part two of Unsolved Heist. Let's start with the 2005 bank robbery, the Banco Central robbery in Fortaleza, Brazil. This wasn't your wham-bam kind of robbery. It was very thought out. Well, for the most part, until it wasn't. In 2005, a group of men rented a property and then set up their business of a landscaping company. The shop was only a few blocks away from Banco Central. How do you think the robbery was pulled off? Well, the men spent 3 months digging a tunnel that was approximately 256 feet long and 13 feet below street level from their business to directly below the bank. Talk about dedication. Over a weekend in August is when all their hard work would be put to the final test. We all can safely assume they used the tunnel to gain access to the bank. Kinda given with the long-ass tunnel they dug. Once they were inside, they either avoided the bank sensors, talk about some amazing ninja skills, or they disabled the sensors. From there, they go on to break through almost 4 feet of steel-enforced concrete to be able to enter the vault. Once in, they steal 5 containers, which weigh more than 7,000 pounds, holding approximately 70 million worth of reals, which is Brazilian currency. So, 70 million reals is approximately the equivalent of $13,847,680 in U.S. dollars. I googled it. None were the wiser until Monday morning when the bank employees were coming into work. So far, the would-be robbers seem to have a thoroughly and meticulous thought-out plan. They whoopsied, though. They made two costly mistakes. First, the police would eventually find a large amount of white powder, chalk, that the robbers used to cover their fingerprints. So they thought. One of the dipshits left one single print. Whoopsie! Mistake number two. This is a doozy. I'm no mastermind to crimes, but even I would know not to do this. One of the guys bought not one, but 10 cars all at once the very next day from when they robbed the bank. Talk about an Uber dumbass. And he paid all in cash, which raised red flags. And it was also in a poor region of Brazil. So he paid all in cash and dropping that amount of money in a poor region of Brazil. So no, that wasn't suspicious at all.
Oh, definitely not.
Due to his lapse in judgment, the police were able to catch up with the trailer that were carrying the cars, which was in another state. Get this, inside three of the vehicles, bundles of 50 real bills. And again, the real is Brazilian currency. There were over three dozen people that were accused of participating in the heist. 26 of the accused ended up in jail for various crimes, and a few of them even escaped. All in all, only about 8 million of the 70 million was ever recovered. This was the biggest robbery in the history of Brazil. All I got? Damn dumbass. Now, the next heist is none other than the Great Train Robbery in England. A train going from Glasgow to London on August 8, 1963, was ambushed on the Bendigo Railroad Bridge in Buckinghamshire. A group of 15 robbers had rigged the track signals to stop the train. Of course, a remote location was chosen. Even though the robbers weren't armed, they still chose violence. They beat the crap out of the train driver. After doing so, they take off with a whopping £2.6 million, which is $61 million U.S. dollars. Police would later find and gather evidence of where the robbers' hideout was that they fled to. Due to all the evidence gathered, majority of the gang would be prosecuted. The money, however, would never be recovered. The ringleaders were sentenced to 30 years in prison. That included Ronald Arthur Ronnie Biggs, who later escapes, and Bruce Napoleon Reynolds, who goes on to work as a consultant for movie and publishing a book. The movie is called Buster and was released in 1988, and the book is The Autobiography of a Thief, The Man Behind the Great Train Robbery, which was published in 1995. On to the Dunbar robbery in LA that happened in September 1997. At least six men stole $18.9 million in cash from the Dunbar Armored Truck Depot in LA. The alibi the six men established began in the evening at a house party in Long Beach, where they would sneak out shortly after making their whereabouts known. They changed into black clothing and then drove to the depot. They arrived at the depot shortly after midnight and entered through a side door. The few employees that were working were tied up and forced to lie face down on the floor. The robbers get to work. They made their way to the vault area and used bolt cutters to break the padlocks on the metal cages, which contained the depot's cash. Most of the money was $20 bills, which was going to drop-offs at ATMs throughout the LA area. The robbers tossed the money into metal carts and then wheeled the carts to the building's loading dock so they could dump the money into a U-Haul truck. One of the men rented the U-Haul truck before the robbery. As they leave, they smash all of the security cameras inside of the depot and take all of the videotapes. Guess what? Not chicken butt this time. Due to one of the men renting a U-Haul, that was the group's demise. A plastic taillight lens somehow fell off of the truck at the depot, and the FBI was able to match it to the U-Haul truck that was rented. The genius, Alan Pace III, was a former security officer for Dunbar. He was very familiar with the security process. He and the rest of the group were convicted. Four of them pled guilty. Authorities were able to recover about $5 million, which was in the form of homes, cars, and other valuables. The remaining money, yep, you guessed it, was never recovered. The next heist is deemed the largest gold heist in British history, and it's the case of the Brinksmat robbery in Britain. On November 26, 1983, during the morning hours, six men entered a warehouse at London's Heathrow Airport that happened to belong to the security company Brinksmat. The men were described as wearing balaclavas, also known as a monkey cap. Okay, I've never heard of it being called a monkey cap. That cracks me up, though. Yeah, I'm easily amused, I know. I refer to them as a ski mask.
I was getting ready to ask you what a monkey cap
is. I know, not a monkey cap, and definitely not a balaclava. Gee willikers. Anywho, the vault in the warehouse consisted of more than $3 million in cash. The robbers were privy to this information because they had inside help. What they were unaware of, the vault had more than 7,000 bars of gold. Quite the happy surprise for them. The men were armed and go on to tie up the guards. They don't stop there, though. The sick twats poured gasoline onto the guards and threatened to burn their asses. My words. If they didn't give them the keys and the codes to the vault. What do you think happened? Of course, that's right. The robbers got what they wanted. They loaded the gold into a van and drove off, but their escape would be short-lived. The squealer, also the inside man, Anthony Black, was implicated quickly and gave up the names of the others involved. Another dumbass, Mickey McAvoy, with his share paid cash for a house and bought two security dogs. You'll never guess what he named them. Brinks and Matt. Seriously, get a clue. McAvoy and Black's brother-in-law, Brian Robinson, were sentenced to 25 years in prison. Again, the police were never able to recover majority of the gold. The final heist that I'm going to share closes out the two-part episodes of the Unsolved Heist and is considered the largest jewel robbery to ever happen in France and is one of the largest in the world. That title belongs to none other than the Harry Winston Heist. In 2008 in Paris, the exquisite Harry Winston jewelry store was the target of a smash and grab. All the cases I've shared have all been meticulously thought out plans, for the most part. But that's not the case here. We can call it a wham bam thank you ma'am kind of deal. The four men are armed but are dressed as women. These men, well, so-called women, what a disguise, forced their way into the posh jewelry store, pushing employees and customers into a corner. If you're wondering why the employees and customers listen, they were held at gunpoint. After this, the thieves stole almost every piece of jewelry on display and also emptied two storage cases in the back. Clearly, they had inside help because those storage cases were supposedly in a top secret location, and then they were referring to the employees by their first name. They get in and get out quick-like with more than $100 million in merchandise. Lady Luck would not be on their side for long. The French media dubbed this the steal of the century, with eight men being arrested. The man that is believed to be the mastermind is Duodai Yayawi. Please forgive my mispronunciation. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, while others received only 9 months in jail. Police found $19 million worth of the jewelry stuffed in a drain in the Parisian suburb of Seine Saint-Denis. What shouldn't come as a shock, majority of the loot has never been recovered. In closing, if you're going to go through all this shit of pulling off a successful heist, continue to operate at a strategic level. If these cases showcase anything, it is what not to do. Again, I'm just being a smartass. Don't attempt anything illegal or harmful. Remember, don't try this at home or anywhere, kids.
Next, we have Amanda Millie Dowler. On March 21st, 2002, just after 3 p.m., 13-year-old Amanda Millie Dowler, who goes by Millie, left school for the day in Weybridge in Surrey, Great Britain. Millie planned on staying late at school that day to do some artwork with a friend, but they had finished up on their lunch and was able to leave on time that day. Millie and a friend walked to the Weybridge Railway Station. The two girls got off the train at Walton-on-the-Thames Station. Millie normally got off at the next stop, but she wanted to get some food with her friend. Just before 4 p.m., Millie called her dad, Bob, to let him know she would be home in half an hour. When Millie didn't return home at the time she said, her parents reported her missing at about 7 p.m. that evening. The police retraced her steps. Just after 4 p.m., Millie headed down Station Avenue alone. One of Millie's sister Gemma's friends saw Millie on Station Avenue.
Say that five times fast.
I know, I couldn't even say it once. There was a CCTV camera at the end of the Station Avenue, but there was no sign of Millie in the footage. It made no sense. She was walking down that way. She should have been seen in the footage walking past.
Oh, that's peculiar.
Mm-hmm. Police had no idea what happened to Millie as she walked down that road. A huge search took place. Police knocked on doors and talked to people who were in that area at the time. In the CCTV footage, they noticed a car had stopped and appealed for information, but the driver came forward quickly. It was a mother and her son. They had no knowledge of what happened to Millie. The search went on for months with no new information coming up. After about 6 months, the Dallers received the most devastating news.
Mm.
On September 18, 2002, all hope of finding Millie alive was shattered. Mushroom pickers discovered remains in Yateley Heath Woods near Yateley in Hampshire. Dental records would be needed to identify the remains, and due to decomposition, the cause of death could not be determined.
Aww.
There were no clues, and Millie's clothes and belongings were missing. In 2004, an officer from Surrey transferred to a new station. He was investigating women who were murdered in the area and noticed the circumstances of the same cases were similar to Millie's. A man named Levi Belfield was being questioned in relation to those other cases. Levi, at the time of Millie's disappearance, lived only 50 yards from where she was last seen.
Damn, that's really close.
Levi lived with his girlfriend Emma at that time, and on the day Millie went missing, she said she had no idea where he was. He didn't return home until between 10 and 11 p.m. that night.
Damn.
Emma told police that at the time, Levi drove a red Daewoo Dexia. Police went back to the CCTV footage and saw the car. It drove past at 4:32 p.m. The car was reported missing 8 days later and has never been found.
Jesus. Okay, before you continue on, do you know what kind of car that is? I have no idea, so.
The picture that I seen, it kind of reminded me of like an old Chevy, like Chevette. Like,
oh, okay.
Just a tiny little.
Oh, okay. I was just curious. I'm like, what the hell kind of car is that? Okay, you can continue now.
Police learned through investigating Levi that he hated women. Levi would drive around bus stops and try to talk to young women and girls who were alone. When he didn't get what he wanted from them, his harassment and stalking escalated.
So how the hell did he manage to get a girlfriend if he despised women? I wonder if she was abused or anything. I'm kind of curious about that.
I have no idea. That was all that I seen
about
her. Oh,
no, I figured. I'm just kind of curious, you know, spitballing. Like, I wonder, like, how did he get a girlfriend?
And... yeah. I was thinking the same as I was writing it.
Okay.
In February 2003, 19-year-old Marcia McDonald was found bleeding to death yards from her home. Marcia had severe injuries from a hammer.
Damn.
And would die 2 days later in the hospital.
That's sad.
A few months later, he ran over Kate Sheedy.
Jesus!
But she survived.
Well, good. Tough chick.
In August 2004, 22-year-old Amali Delarange was beaten and died later in the hospital from severe head injuries.
Jeez.
Levi was charged with the murder of Marcia McDonald and Amalie DeLange and the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. He was convicted of the murders in 2008 and was sentenced to life. In 2010, he was finally charged with Millie's murder.
Nice. Good. At least the little girl got justice.
It is believed that Levi was on Station Avenue that day and was hiding behind some bushes. And when he saw Millie alone, he grabbed her. He took her to his flat yards away and assaulted her before driving her to his mother's house. He raped her outside his mother's house and then raped her and tortured her at a third location.
Jeez.
The horrific abuse, rape, and torture of Millie took place over a 14-hour period.
Aw, that poor little thing. I mean, all these people, these sick fuckers.
Levi then strangled Millie to death.
Jesus.
Levi confessed in prison to the murder of Millie. Levi was the first prisoner in history to receive two whole life orders, which means he will serve the sentence without the possibility of parole.
Well, good. I mean, that's the least he could, you know, get dealt.
Yep.
I mean, that's just shitty, though. But the thing is, I'm still surprised because I know, like, in Britain and everything, they have the CCTV, mm-hmm. whatever, like, everywhere. So people have to really know or study, like, where the blind spots are, I guess, to be able to get away. Because we've watched some shows. I mean, yeah, so I'm just basing it off shows and whatnot. But, yeah, that shit's everywhere. So to be able to find the blind spot.
Yeah, but this was also back in, like, 2002, so it might not have been.
Okay, let's not call it years ago. So, well, you know.
I mean, technically.
Gosh, let's not. Yeah, it has. Damn it, I feel old. Over 20 years ago. Oh, okay. Yeah. Shit, I'm old.
Okay, I have a did you hear?
Oh, goody goody gumdrops.
A woman in South Carolina was charged for driving under the influence, but even the police were shocked upon discovering that it wasn't an actual vehicle, but a toy car.
What? How the hell would she do? Oh, God.
Megan Holman drank a little too much that day and said that she was on a scavenger hunt on her toy truck and that she is all set to be a wrestler, according to her dad.
What the fuck? Did she get a DUI for driving the toy car?
I don't know. I couldn't find it.
Because, was it battery operated, I wonder?
I'm assuming.
Because, I mean, because then that wouldn't be really a, you know, motorized vehicle because it's battery operated. So,
well, she was still driving.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
you can't
true.
Even ride a bike and drink anymore. So,
yeah, that's true. And I mean, people
there's
can
no
get
the motor DUI. There. You're yeah. just using your feet.
Oh, and then people can get a DUI for, you know, driving a freaking lawnmower.
Yeah, I kind of understand that one because it does have a motor.
Well, yeah,
and it
but
could be
still.
A little dangerous if they turn on their
yeah
blades and
or run over somebody.
Yeah,
but still, a toy car. I've not heard of someone getting pulled over. For, you know, driving a toy car.
Yeah.
While intoxicated.
Yep. Well, now we know we can't do it.
Yes. Well, maybe around where we live and everything, they'll pick and choose who they pull over. Oh, that's too funny. That was funny. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you join us every Friday for more episodes.
You can find us on Facebook as Sweet and Twisted True Crime, on Instagram at Sweet and Twisted Pod, or you can email us at sweetandtwistedpod@gmail.com.
Until next time,
keep it sweet,
but slightly twisted.
Bye.
Toodles!